If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast guest is Jan Bill. Jan is Professor of Viking Age Archaeology and Curator of the Viking Ship Collection at the Museum of Cultural History in Oslo, Norway. He's also head of the steering group for the Gjellestad ship project, which is the first Viking ship to be excavated for many years. Our content director, Dave Musgrove, called him to talk Viking ships and to find out what's happening with the ongoing dig.
Welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I'd like to be here. Thank you very much.
So first question, a stupid question perhaps, but it's my role in these things to ask stupid questions. What do we actually mean by a Viking ship?
Well, I think most people think of Viking ships as those long raiding warships that occurred at the coasts of Europe. But really, if you're looking at the material that we have, it's much more than that, because we have ships of many different sorts. And I think we should rather think of Viking ships as ships being built by Scandinavians, by Vikings, during the Viking Age, and then look at this whole range of sea crafts that was actually in use.
When do we start to see craft then that we would identify as Viking? What's the earliest examples that we're aware of?
Depends on when you decide that the Viking Age begins for you. The first example that we really have of something that we would call a Viking ship is probably that from Salme in Estonia. And unfortunately, it's not very well preserved. Only the iron nails were still lying in the ground in the pattern that they had been in the boat. But that is a find which dates to around 750. And the reason that we would call it a Viking ship is perhaps mostly because it was obviously used in a Viking activity. It was filled with dead warriors who were buried in it. and they had been on a raiding party or some mission into the Baltic and ended up on the island of Ursel, Saaremaa, where they died and were buried.
And that's a mid-8th century age, isn't it, that we think that is? So a little earlier than our traditional Viking period starts in the UK, where we think about Lindisfarne and the end of the 8th century.
Yes, definitely. And I think this is one of the things that are happening within Viking Age research these years, that we are kind of pushing the border backwards in time. Earlier, we were mainly relying on the written sources to define when this period started. And now we are looking more into the archaeology, and we see that a lot of the things that are like defining the Viking Age, they actually start somewhat earlier in the mid-8th century.
And the Saaremaa ship burial that you mentioned there, that has been excavated. Is there still a lot we can learn from that? Is the excavation sort of complete, and is the analysis complete of that? Or is there still a lot to learn from that?
There's definitely a lot to learn still. And one of the things that really haven't been analysed yet, that is actually the ship itself. So we don't really know how it looked, and it will of course be extremely interesting to see, because that might well be the oldest sailing ship that we have remains of in the Viking world.
And you mentioned earlier that there are different sorts of ships, different craft that fall under the remit of Viking ship. Can you just very quickly give us a sense about what those sorts of ships would be?
It would basically be a lot of things that we see today as well. People go out fishing, so they need a boat for that. So that's the very small ones. And then you have vessels which were more meant for traveling. You have to remember that that was really the big mode of transportation in Scandinavia in those days, because it was hard to travel over land. A lack of roads and so on, a lot of steep mountains, forests and so on. So really the water was the way. And so you had also vessels to travel around in, and then you had, of course, the big ships, which were perhaps mostly thought of for warfare. And towards the end of the Viking Age, we also get specialized cargo ships, which really were meant to be economical and transport goods at a low cost.
Those would be the canar type ships. Is that the
yes,
correct?
That's, that's right.
So just thinking, I suppose, you know, the traditional views of these big scary Viking long ships that are used for raiding purposes and sending armed warriors around the place. What particular, if anything, was unique about those ships? Were they better than ships available to other peoples in the North Atlantic at this period?
Well, we like to think that they are. In fact, we don't really know it, because very little is preserved of ships from other areas from that time. But what we do know is that the Scandinavian ships were built in a tradition which we can follow several centuries backwards in time. And at that time, it was specialized rowing ships. So they did not use the sail. They were only propelled by oars. And this, of course, meant a huge incentive to build them as light as possible, because then they were easier to row. And this is actually exactly what we see also with the Viking ships, that compared to ship remains from other parts of Northern Europe, they are very lightly built, and they are, for that reason, speedy. They are easy to pull up on a shore. They don't need a lot of harbour constructions. You can take them up rivers. You can take them over land if need be. So we really think that that was perhaps the main secret behind the Viking ship, that they were so light that they could be used for a lot of things.
And when did they start using sail power then? When did that become more important?
Well, probably it started in Scandinavia, somewhere in the perhaps late 7th, at latest in the 8th century. And then it spread probably from south toward north. And we can see that we still find specialized rowing ships in Norway up in towards the end of the 8th century, at a time where definitely also sailing ships were moving around.
And presumably for the longer voyages, for the voyages crossing from Scandinavia to Britain, for instance, it would have been a combination of sail power and oar power that that got them across.
Yes, the question is, of course, when they did start to sail directly across the North Sea. It's kind of a challenge to do that in an open rowing boat. So maybe they only did that as they started to use sail. The alternative is, of course, to travel along the coast of the North Sea. And there were good reasons for doing that, because that would also bring them down to, and in contact with one of the most viable trading networks in Northern Europe. So for a pirate, that wouldn't be a bad place to go.
Now, just in terms of making them, I mean, there's been lots of work done in museums, including the ones you've worked in, sort of reconstructing Viking ships and trying to see how they worked. What do we know about the process of actually building these craft back in the Viking period? Presumably, they didn't have designs and plans that they were modelled on. So, was it just design experience handed down from carpenter to carpenter, shipwright to shipwright? What have we learned?
I think that is one thing that we are certain of, but we can also say that this was not special for the Vikings. This was basically how shipbuilding was done back in those days. But what we do see when we're looking at the ways that Viking ships have been built is that they have been extremely carefully built. So they have a very strong aesthetic sense, a very strong idea about quality. And that's probably telling us that it was very much the same people who was in control of shipbuilding over generations. So it was a very traditional thing to be a boat builder, and it would proceed in the family most likely. And in that way, you would collect experience, rules of thumb, a lot of different knowledge over generations, and it would be in, so to say, living in the master boat builder and passed on to the next generation over time. Of course, there were some means to control the shape of the hull that you were constructing. You would probably be using sticks or ropes with marks on or things like that in order to record and preserve essential measurements so that you could replicate them in the next vessel that you were building. But it was really very much dependent on what was stored in the head of the master shipbuilder.
So presumably the master shipbuilder would have been a person of some importance in the local society.
He must have been very important, yes, because the ships were so important, and the fact that we see that ships are so carefully built indicates that they were very important to people. They were willing to invest a lot of resources in making the ship not only functional, but also making it having lines that run uninterrupted, to have decorations on them, and so on and so forth.
So we've had quite a few years now of researching and analysing and looking at real examples of Viking ships that have been discovered. What have we learnt about the likely experience of being on board one of these ships in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. Presumably an uncomfortable journey would have been the first thing.
Yes, I think actually the first thing that you would experience when you went on board, that was probably the smell. You would, of course, have all this tar all around, because tar was used in order to conserve and protect the wood, but also parts of the rigging and so on. So if the ship was freshly tarred, it would be very sticky, and that would get on your clothes and in your skin and everywhere. And you would, of course, smell it very well. You would probably also smell some unidentifiable rotten smell, and that would be the fats that is being used in the sail in order to help make it more windproof. That was necessary to do that, and but it doesn't really smell good. So you would probably be happy that you were outdoor all the time, as you are on a Viking ship, because there is no place to go indoor. So this, of course, also means that you're exposed to the weather. You get wet when it rains and hot when the sun shines. And then you'll probably also experience that it was pretty cramped on board, because ships were expensive, and especially for warships. I mean, the whole idea was to try to transport as many people as possible in one unit, because that is what would make it efficient as a weapon. So you'll probably be quite close to your neighbor, and you would try to find a place to have your stuff with you, your rain clothes and so on and so forth. So probably it would be not very much like being on a modern sailing boat, but a rather cramped, cold and smelly experience.
And if you wanted to sleep, presumably you just sleep where you sat?
Well, you would lay down, I suppose. And we do believe that that's actually sleeping bags were an important part of the equipment that you would bring with you. Of course, not a modern one, but perhaps one made of skin to keep you reasonable, dry and warm along the way. So at least what we see from the experiments that we have been making traveling on board Viking longships across the North Sea and with people sleeping on board, that is that there are just people lying everywhere.
And going to the toilet, I imagine that would involve a bucket?
For safety, you would perhaps prefer to do it in a bucket on board and not trying to hang over the gunwale. I suppose that Vikings didn't want to drown either.
What do we know about Vikings' propensity for swimming? Were the people sailing these ships able to swim? Do we have any evidence of that?
Well, we do have a few mentions in sagas, but that's more of the type that this king was such a sporty person and he was a very good swimmer and things like that. Whether it was something that a lot of people could, we really don't know. I would suppose that people living along the coasts in places where the water was not too cold, they would probably learn to swim as in their youth, playing around. But that a lot of people who came from the inland areas, they would not have that skill. And there's also a facet to it that the sea was not just a natural thing as it is for us today, for the Scandinavians at that time. The sea was populated. I mean, the basic idea in Norse mythology is that there is this huge serpent which lies around the world in the sea. And of course, that meant that the sea was dangerous. There were hidden dangers in the deep. So maybe you didn't even want to go into the water for that reason.
Now, you're an expert in Viking ships, so I imagine you have been on one of these reconstructions at once or twice in your career. I've been to Roskilde and I've seen the ships there, and I remember the smell very distinctly. Have you sampled actual sailing or rowing on these ships?
Well, I've actually been part of building a couple of them many years ago, and of course I have been sailing also, but I'm not the most skilled Viking ship sailor in the world, I have to admit that. But yes, and I could say the experience has for me only been positive, apart from seasickness, of course. it's a great feeling sailing on board one of the ships, and one of the things that you experience when the ship gets up speed and moves along quickly, that is actually that the whole hull starts to shake a little bit, and that's a very 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 vibrant feeling. You have the impression that now you are running right on as quick as the ship can go through the water. That's fascinating.
Sounds exhilarating.
Mm.
So look, one of the things that I think is really interesting, which I hadn't really thought about before I did a bit of reading about this, is what we can imagine or learn from the very fact that these ships were built, what it tells us about the society and economy that was behind it. And I'm thinking of, you know, one example would be the number of sheep that you would need to have sufficient wool to make a sail. For instance, it's been estimated some wildly enormous number of sheep is required. Are we learning a lot now about the level of resources that would have gone into making these ships and what it tells us about the society that sat around it?
I think that's one of the big results of the experimental archaeological work during the last decades that has been made, that we now know much more about the amount of materials, the amount of work hours which is going into to one of these ships. And that gives us a perspective on the Viking Age that we didn't have before. And it is really quite impressive amounts that you need. You mentioned the sheep. I mean, about 60 sheep for producing enough wool for one sail for a large warship. You would also need perhaps some 15 big trunks of oaks, tree trunks about a meter in diameter or something like that, in order to produce all the planks and so on and so forth. You would need perhaps a couple of hundred kilos of iron. You would need a lot of tar. You would need a lot of rope and so on. So, of course, this was really major investments. And I think one of the most fascinating things to see is how both the ships themselves evolves, changes during the Viking Age, becomes larger, larger cargo capacity and so on. But we also see how the expeditions made with these ships also changes in character, from being like small raiding parties moving along the coasts, making surprise attacks at different places, quickly disappearing again, up to large fleet operations involving more than 100 ships, or in the most magnificent case, of course, William's conquest of England involving 1,000 ships. We're really looking at very, very big undertakings, which means that a lot of power, a lot of resources must have been concentrated at the hands of those who decided to carry these operations through. So what we really see with the ships and how they are being used, that is the contour of societies that are becoming more and more hierarchical, and where more and more resources and power is concentrated in the hand of few people. When that is said, of course, this took many different forms, and there's much evidence pointing to many of these fleet operations actually being not really with one clear leader. It's participation is more like, oh yes, let's go on this plundering or this this trip together, and I bring my ships and you bring yours, and let's go and make some money. So it wasn't. It's not always a king who is requesting his subordinates to participate.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
We have to remember that the ships were like the cars of the Viking Age. That was the main tool for traveling around in very, very many situations. And yeah, you could try to imagine that you should describe the history of car development with only five examples today.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Right, so now we've had a bit of an overview of Viking ships and what we know about them so far. Could we move on to chat about this recent find at Jellestad, which you're involved with? The excavation is going on right now as we speak in October. Could you just introduce us first to the area and how this ship was located in the first place?
Yeah, then we will be going to the Oslo Fjord region, that is in the southeast of Norway, and we'll be going to the east side of the fjord, just some 20 kilometers south of the finding place for the Tune ship, one of the fairly well-preserved Viking ships from Norway. And what we have there is an enormous burial mound from the 6th, 7th century or something like that. And then just in the vicinity of that, an open plain where we know from earlier records that there have been several big mounds too. A few years ago, the farmer there wanted to put down drainage in the field, and therefore there was made an archaeological survey and a geophysical survey of the region, of the area, the field. And what came up there was the ruins of these mounds which have been there previously, and traces of some longhouses. But especially one of these mound ruins was extremely interesting because there was a very, very clear shadow of a ship in that one. And it was not a small ship either. This shadow was more than 19 meters long. So it was very clear from that evidence, without digging even a single square meter, we could say that this has to be a ship burial of the same character as those that we know from Gokstad and Oseberg and Tuna, as I briefly mentioned.
And those other ship burials, Gokstad, Oseberg and Tuna, they are the ships are now in your care in the museum in Oslo.
Yes, that's right. That's those that we have on display here in Oslo, yes. So this was, of course, extremely exciting for everybody. And we quickly decided to make a very, very small excavation to figure out what was actually preserved of this find. And we found also on the geophysics that a drainage pipe has been put into the ship at an earlier occasion. So what we decided to do was simply to dig down to that pipe and empty the trench in which it had been put and look at the ship from there, because then we would not destroy anything of the preserved ship. And so we did. And what came out of that was the realization that at that particular point in the ship burial, the only wood which was left was the lower part of the keel, which was below this drainage pipe. And we took it up, took a saw and cut off a piece and took it up to look at it and learned some important things. The most exciting, perhaps, was that we were able to date it by means of dendrochronology. It turned out that it was of oak and that the oak tree from which it had been made was felled at the very earliest in 733. Possibly it could be a good deal later, because the earrings were really thin. So if the shipbuilder had been axing away some earrings, then they would be missing. And so basically we believe that the ship could be from any date between 733 and say 950 or something like that. The other thing that we learned too was not so funny, because that was actually that soft rot was in the wood and thriving very well. And that is a very, very bad thing, because soft rot is capable of destroying such wood within a very, very short span of time. We were really very, very anxious that this might be the case here, and so was the government in Norway. So actually, they decided to spend money to excavate this ship burial, or at least the ship in the ship burial, already this year, and this is what we're doing now.
So if you hadn't discovered that evidence of the rot, would it have been more of a conversation as to whether it was appropriate to excavate at this stage?
Yes, I think so. If we had seen that the wood was preserved and it was safe as it is, then of course it would have been a discussion, because then there would not be any strong need for it to be excavated right now. And you could choose to wait until methods have been even better. You could choose to say, okay, we want to make this research excavation, but we won't do it until we have a huge pile of money and can do a lot of things at the same time and so on. And the same would be true if we had seen that everything had rotted away. So it was just the impression and nothing more that could rot away, then we would probably not have been in such a hurry to do something with it. But exactly this situation with some wood left, but not for very long anymore, that put a lot of pressure on the situation.
So the plan is now to excavate the entire carcass of the ship, and take it all out. Is that right?
Yes. What we're doing is that we are trying to achieve several things with the excavation. Most important is, of course, to salvage the information which is there. So that means that during excavation, we need to make sure that we really record everything which can tell us something about the burial ritual, about the ship, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, a very high priority is at also salvaging the preserved ship timbers, which are in the bottom. They are, of course, below everything which was put into the ship. And for that, we need to keep them waterlogged, wet, and we need to also keep them wet and all the time when we take them up and do the documentation and bring them in for conservation and so on. But then, of course, there are all the parts of the ships which have rotted away, and that's much more tricky with those, what we are going to do there. Really, we have decided to wait to decide what to do until we know exactly how this material look, if it makes any sense to try to preserve the shape of the ship in some way, or whether we in the end will have to simply record everything and remove it. We don't know that yet, but we are working in a manner so that we can do both.
And do you expect to find an actual burial in this ship? Do you think you'll find a body?
I'm not sure that we will find a body, and that is because the burial have apparently been disturbed at several locations, and one we know of historically that was shortly before 1880. At that time, the mound which had been covering the ship burial was removed by the farmer, there are reports that the farmer also found some things and took out pieces of the ship and put them into the barn and things like that. And we do see very clearly some of the places where it has been dug down in recent time. Then we also see that there is another, what is possibly another plundering that has taken place perhaps at a much earlier date. And that is encompassing most of the area where the central burial have been. So the chances are that most of what was there in that area has been destroyed. but we'll see that when we get down further. And I'm sure that in the bottom of this ship, we'll find layers which are basically undisturbed. And we'll see how much have ended up down there. One of the things that we have been finding within the last week or so, that is the skeleton of a big mammal, probably a horse, lying within the central burial area. Might have been inside even a burial chamber there. And that is, of course, very good, because that shows us that at least some skeletal remains can survive to some extent.
Mm. And what else have you found so far? You've made some interesting nail findings, I think.
Yeah, as we are digging down into the ship from the top, then it becomes increasingly better preserved. And one of the most recent finds is that we have started to find the big iron nails, which are basically fastening the top of the framed timbers, floor timbers we call them, to the side of the ship, exactly at the transition between the bottom and the side. And we are very happy about that, because that's like a key point to identify in order to understand the construction of the ship. And now we know that we can expect to find these nails along both sides on that level. That will give us a very good impression of how the ship originally looked. So that is really important.
So we have got evidence of some of these ship burials already from the craft we mentioned earlier, Gokstad, Oseberg, and Tune, for instance. What more are we going to learn from this ship, or what are you most excited or hopeful that we might learn?
Well, if it turns out to be a really early grave dating back to the 8th century. Then, of course, it will be immensely exciting to see if this is a sailing ship or not. If it's a later date that comes out in the end, then it would not be surprising to find a sailing ship there. But it would be interesting to see how it relates to the other ships that we know of from that time. We have several ship finds from Western Norway. The Oseberg ship was built there. We also have some ship remains from Karmøy on the west coast. And then we have several ships which have been built in eastern Norway, as the Gokstad ship and the Tune ship. Now it will be very exciting to see if this ship can actually help us to learn more about regional differences or functional differences in how the Viking ships were being built. We have to remember that the ships were like the cars of the Viking Age. That was the main tool for traveling around in very, very many situations. You could try to imagine that you should describe the history of car development with only 5 examples today. That would be very, very difficult. And it's the same thing with the Viking ships. We have very few compared to all the variants that we expect to be. But I think there's a completely different angle on this Jellestad ship burial that is as important. And that is to this is the first time that we are really excavating a monumental ship grave for 100 years. And this is with all the developments that have taken place in archaeology since the last time. We can do so much more in order to document and analyze the actions that took place during the burial. So we can get much, much closer to actually understanding the burial ritual and the question why unearthed people at that time choose to make these very, very big, very, very expensive burials.
And that's obviously a fascinating question that that would be really good to answer. I suppose just wrapping up a bit now, thinking about fascinating questions, I wonder, you must speak to members of the public an awful lot about Viking ships and field some curious questions and some very common questions. I wonder, what are the most commonly asked questions about Viking ships that you have to answer?
Well, the most common one is it real? And that's a question I get from people who just comes into to the Viking Ship Museum and see the Oseberg ship in front of them, and they just don't believe that this is really from the Viking Age. They think this must be something that has been built up in modern times. It's not. It is original. So I think that's a very, very common. And then, of course, people are interested in many different aspects, but many of them is about how would it be to be on board, what was it like, and I think that is easy to understand because this is really the way that we can relate to that kind of finds ourselves. How was it actually to be sailing on one of these vessels? How was it to see such a ship coming towards the shore where you were standing? That fascinates people.
Professor Jan Bill, thank you very much for your time. That was a fascinating conversation, and we look forward to hearing more about the Gjellestad excavation. When do you think there might be more information coming? I guess all the time as the dig progresses, but when's it supposed to be concluding? When's it going to be done by?
At the moment, it looks like we are going to excavate into December, something like that. And then we will hopefully be able to take up the timbers from in December and start the study of them. And the knowledge that we are getting from this excavation, it will not stop coming by end of December. It will continue through research during the coming years.
And I guess the plan and hope is that it might be something that could be displayed as part of this new museum that you're developing in Oslo as we speak.
Well, definitely the story about the Gjellestad ship will be part of the new museum. In what form, we'll have to see. Depends on how much is preserved, I guess.
That was Jan Bill. If you want to find out more about the Vikings, enter that into the search bar on our website at historyextra.com. And don't forget that if you enjoyed this conversation, then be sure to head over to historyextra.com/Viking5 to read the things that everyone should know about Viking ships, according to Professor Bill. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow to hear about the experiences of Black people in the Second World War.